coming to you from my apartment that doubles as a podcast recording studio. This is What Should I Do With My Life with Steph Horowitz. I'm Steph Horowitz. Thanks for joining me. This podcast is about how none of us know what we're doing. None of us have it figured out. No matter if you seem like you have it all together, you really don't, so be honest. We're going to talk about real stories from real people, their experiences, how they're figuring it out. From career pivots to being in the same industry for 40 years, we're going to hash this thing out so we can all find more meaning and passion in our work and day-to-days. Hello, everyone. Today, we are talking about innovation. We're talking about risks, and we are talking about change. I'm excited to introduce you to Samar Farooqi. Samar and I first met through work, and since then, we've collaborated on different projects like the Strategy Remix, which we're going to talk about. I'm very excited to introduce him to you today. Samar has over 20 years of experience working in the tech industry in various roles. As a tech consultant in change management, transformation, industry, he currently works as the Vice President of Strategy, Cloud Innovation, and Business Development, leading the SAP Industry Cloud Strategy for Consumer Industries. Samar's love and passion for technology and innovation started at a very early age, which we're going to learn about shortly. In this episode, we talk about what it really means for organizations to come face-to-face with change and what those implications are. Samar shares about the risk he took that didn't go his way, and we chat about personal branding and why we don't just need to represent our employer's brand online, despite what we may think. Please enjoy Samar Farooqi. I hear you perfectly. Okay. You look perfect. The background, the plants, I see like a bonsai tree back there or something. It's giving me Cobra Kai vibes. Do you watch Cobra Kai?
Yes, I do.
It's so good. New season. New season coming soon.
Yes, can't wait for season 5. Yes.
Oh my God. Yeah, I love it.
I did a post about it as well on LinkedIn. I took all the characters from the season 4 premiere and put them through a Myers-Briggs test.
I remember seeing this post. Genius, super creative. Yeah. Maybe I'll share that after. But yes. Samar, I'm really happy to have you on the show. So welcome to What Should I Do With My Life? Yeah, this is like a long time coming, I feel, right?
Yes. Yeah, I've been interacting, working together, I've joined some of your sessions before. I've been talking about podcasting, and you've been a real inspiration for that as well for me, you know, sharing your journey, your insights, and I've been able to share with you some of mine, right? So
I agree. I think we're really good at shooting the shit and hashing out the stuff. So in true fashion for What Should I Do With My Life, I want to ask you in one sentence, Samar, what do you do?
Well, I work in the tech industry on the advisory side. So I'm a tech consultant, you could say. Been in the industry 20 odd years, in and around SAP principally, but I've had many roles. I've been a consultant, been an implementer, been an advisor. I've worked in industry, in retail and consumer industries. So I've worn a few hats and swapped chairs, if you like, from the buy side and the sell side of the technology industry. So I've been a customer of the company that I work for today, but I've also in the past been a buyer and a seller of the whole thing. And I think it's that journey has been super interesting, because now I'm able to reflect in my day job both sides of that coin.
Well, that's a pretty good situation that you can kind of do both of those things or a mix of those things. I wanted to know, and I like asking, what was your first job? Does that have anything to do with what you're doing today?
Yeah, it kind of does, actually. You know, when I was growing up, my dad was not keen for me to go, you know, do a paper round or, you know, work in a supermarket. He's like, no, everything you have to do has to be related to something, right? To get something out of it. You know, so he was keen that, you know, the first couple of jobs I did were sort of internships when I was 15, 16 years old with IT companies locally. The first proper job that I did that I actually got a paycheck for was as a computer operator, which sounds a bit of a strange thing, but back then, I hate to say that, back then, you had computer operators, you had a specialized job to load printer paper into these giant printers. Now, if you imagine back in the day when you used to get your phone bill or something like that, you used to be on that continuous lined paper, used to come out from mainframe computers. Well, it was someone's job to actually load that printer and make sure that was working correctly. So that was my very first paid job. loading printer paper, which I'm very proud of. Actually, to do that job, you had to be certified, right? There was a certification you had to go through. It wasn't quite like, you know, as if you're stacking shelves and just loading paper into it, but there are a few steps involved in that, like preparing the computer, having to log into it and writing these commands and checking the alignment and these kinds of things. You had to do a certification, and which actually started me on my career path. So that advice I received was pretty valid. You know, I always wanted to march into a boardroom, you know, from day one and start telling people what to do, but a couple of people advised me that's not going to happen straight away. You've got to learn the ropes first of this industry, right? You've got to spend some time in the trenches before you can, you know, march into boardrooms and start telling people what they should be doing.
You got to pay your dues, like they say. So you agree with that? Exactly. A lot of people say, you got to pay your dues. You got to put in the blood, sweat, and tears before you barge into the boardroom. You agree with this?
Exactly. Exactly. I remember when I was at university and I was looking at career options, and I went to a career fair and the police were there, and I was like, oh, that could be interesting. I want to join the police. You know, so how long does it take to become a detective? You know, and they're like, well, that takes about 7 years. I'm like, so what? So if I join as a graduate and I go to police college and all of that, yeah, that'll take around a year, 18 months. And then you have to spend 3 years, you know, as a patrolman, you know, on the beat. Like, I'm not going to spend 3 years standing on a street corner and then waiting to be selected, if you do, you know, to climb the slippery ladder to become, oh, I was like, no, forget. But it dawned on me, you know, you're not going to become a judge. You're not going to become a detective. You're not going to become a corporate consultant in technology without having put in, you know, those hard miles or stood on those street corners on rainy days, you know, whatever it takes. You've got to have the discipline and earn the respect of your colleagues to be able to have such opportunities.
I definitely agree with that. Yeah. And I guess no matter what, you're putting in your dues, you got to put in the time. But I guess it's, what does that day-to-day actually look like that aligns with what you want? So on that note, yes. You really are a man of innovation, of technology, even starting early with the printer paper and the computers and getting your hands dirty in that regard. So I'm curious, where did this interest or love for innovation begin? Today we hear so much about organizations needing to be innovative to survive. So what does that even mean? And what does that mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many ways to unpack that, right? And there's three or four layers to your question. So let me try and tackle that piece by piece. So firstly, on the inspiration side, I mean, I was, you know, growing up in the 80s and 90s, when I came of age, you know, I grew up in that sort of techno-optimism era, you know, of Star Trek and all of that. Star Trek, Knight Rider, Airwolf, Street Hawk, whatever, all those TV shows that I was exposed to as a kid, where the overriding philosophy was this kind of techno-optimism, that technology could help people solve problems or fight crime or, you know, serve justice or whatever. And that technology was just right at the cusp of what you might think was plausible or possible. And then something like Star Trek was taking that, you know, far into the future and what humanity could achieve. So I also found that, you know, as a child, very inspirational. You know, and I was like, wow, you know, technology can make a difference, and it's progressive and it's fresh, you know, and it's coming from Silicon Valley. You know, had that kind of amazing buzz around it. So that always kind of, you know, fired me up. And then one of the most formative experiences was, I think I was about 6 or 7. My father in London, he took me to his office. He was a chartered accountant by profession, still is, so they're retired. Took me to his office one weekend. I think he had to finish an audit or something. And there he showed me when I arrived, he said, look at this. There's, in this corner was this beige machine. He said, this is an IBM PC, which was very new in those days. And I think it was the only one in the company or something. So it's quite a privilege to get near this thing. Can you imagine?
Oh, yeah.
And he, I remember he picked me up and plonked me on the chair in front of it. And he typed something on that green screen, on that that prompt. The Starship Enterprise appeared in an ASCII drawing, you know, line by line, green line by line, building up. And my mind was just totally blown. I was like, wow, how did they do that? You know, and ever since then, I had that feeling, how does this thing work? How does it happen? What can you do with it? Where does it take you? This is, I was just so fired up ever since then. I remember asking my dad, you know, can I work in computers when I grow up? And he said, yes. And that kind of, you know, really inspired me. So combined with that kind of techno optimism in the kind of environment I was living in, and during that era, you know, plus the encouragement of my family, I kind of got into technology, which really inspired me. And then to ask your question about innovation and where does it go? I mean, that's kind of related to that, right? There's a continuous pattern of growth. And you know, I lived through that era where there was considerable optimism about it. And that's what they call the post-Apollo era, you know, after the moon landings and the following decade and then the space shuttle and all this kind of thing. There was this kind of optimistic curve being climbed, you know, that technology is going to bring a better tomorrow. Not quite in the kind of 1950s style of, you know, everyone's going to be driving nuclear-powered cars and that kind of thing, but it was a general optimism. And then you had the waves of Microsoft arriving and Apple arriving and, you know, this kind of innovation. So it really felt like something was really happening, right? There was a major play coming about and the world was being transformed. You could see it in front of you. So you could see how innovation had a part to play in terms of delivering that. And then being in or interested in technology was a major part of that, right? So if you're into technology, you're riding that wave already, whether it was Sony or Sega or what's happening in Hollywood or whatever, there was a constant movement. And that was always exciting. And you saw that being transitioned as I matured into the world of business. So this is what business wanted to do, was to leverage technology, find ways to innovate. Although to be fair, companies were always innovating. That's nothing new, right? We shouldn't think innovation is something new. It's Industrial Revolution happened 200 years ago. I think, as I said to you earlier, you know, you can draw a straight line from the first stone axe to a particle accelerator. There's an instinct in all of us, whether we're as individuals, or in tribes and nations and businesses, to innovate, to find the next thing, what's over the hill. Right. And this urge, right, has always been there. But, you know, as I came of age, that this urge and investment was moving into technology. So I was able to catch those two waves, right? The technology era, as well as my own interest.
There really were a lot of layers to my question. So there were a lot of layers to your answer. A few things that stuck out to me. You talked about being so inspired by the TV shows you watched and that really got you excited about technology. And I feel like today it's such a thing trying to get kids excited about technology. Granted, it's a very different generation today. They're using the smartphones. They're using the touch screens already. The one-year-old baby knows how to swipe on the touch screen. But this idea that kids were already excited and into technology, this is nothing new. This was happening, like you said, in the 80s. And it sounds like culture and TV shows really had a big influence on you and I'm sure a lot of other kids and young adults. I also love that you have this formative experience with the IBM, with the computer. And that was, you know, you remember that and with your dad and wow, could I really do this? I mean, I think it's pretty special that you had these kind of formative moments and they've really influenced what you end up doing. When it comes to innovation, and yes, it is natural, like you said, you know, we have it in us always to innovate. At the same time, we know that implementing innovation, making changes, this is hard. Organizationally, people resist change. And a lot of work you've done is transformational, organizational transformation, change management. So what kind of challenges did you face as someone who's trying to help organizations change for the better? And like, how did that affect you and your mood and how you did the work you did?
I think, you know, as I entered the world of work and I started to work for companies, initially, you know, consulting companies and others, delivering change, you know, was part of the job in the sense that, you know, I did computer science at university and you learned that, and I did my master's in IT management and you learned about change management. And a lot of time in academia, when you're studying these things, is spent looking at case studies, you know, what works, what doesn't, how do you overcome resistance to change and this kind of thing. And what, for example, a company is trying to achieve by implementing this change. And then obviously you learn from that at business school and through other training avenues, what is a good way to approach this problem. But separating the academic framing that I'm sure many of us went through, through to the world of practice and actually doing it, you know, when I entered the workforce and started delivering these sorts of projects and came face to face with change. You know, either when I was working as an end user company, typically an IT department implementing something, you might say that's a small change, right? Those are my first experiences as opposed to large projects. But, you know, for example, in my very first job, I was working for an investment bank. And there, you know, I was initially a trainee looking after the mainframe systems. I was programming those, coding them, making changes and tweaks to software that when it was running live was processing millions or billions of dollars of transactions per day. And it was one way quite or inspiring that, wow, you know, you can, you know, have an effect on this sort of system and economics as a whole. And, you know, what you do swings the market and this kind of thing. But what surprised me was, and even asked to implement a change, they had a formal process. There's a change request, user wants to change this particular interface, add this functionality. So you go through the process, design it, test it, deliver it, etc. Sometimes the emotional, visceral reaction you get from people was usually eight times out of 10, not positive. I mean, if it was fine, someone got what they wanted exactly from a change management perspective, no one would say anything. This is okay, fine, works. No. You know, there's nothing there. Right. You know, if something works the way you expect it, and the analogy I soon learned was, it's like a tap or a faucet you have in your house. I mean, you don't care how it works. You turn it on, it works. You don't think twice. You're not going to give a round of applause to the plumber. Great, you know, the hot water's running. Congratulations. You're not going to do that. When something is slightly off, slightly wrong, or doesn't appear how they expected, or the layout is a bit different, or the button has changed, or the icon has changed, oh my God, boom, you know, you get a visceral reaction. And this is something that I was not prepared for, because academia doesn't prepare you for this emotional reaction. And suddenly you feel this big, powerful person or department or group of people is suddenly complaining loudly to you or your boss or whatever that, you know, this don't like it, right? This kind of creates an emotional reaction in you as well. And so I had to go through a few of these cycles to understand that there's a strong emotional component in it. And so when you talk about resistance to change, whether it's small or large, it's often an emotional reaction. And so one of the lessons I learned from that, which was sort of embedded in academia, but in practice, you actually learn what it actually means is, you know, is to take people on the journey with you, you know, make sure they're properly briefed, make sure they fully understand what's going to happen. And you can do whatever you can to prepare as much as possible the target audience or the user or the organization that here's what's going to happen and here's how it's going to work. But it doesn't always mean that it does. You know, I once, one of the big consulting firms, I worked on one of the world's largest projects, and this was a situation where I was brought in as an expert to look at a project that had gone wrong. This was a huge multi-million dollar program in the UK. I don't think I should say who it was, but this is a huge, huge investment that our client had made in a technology solution, which ultimately failed. I'm talking about literally, you know, hundreds of millions of pounds were at stake here. My client was looking to take legal action against their supplier, vendor, and the system integrator who delivered that particular project. I had to approach that as this was after the fact. So it already happened and the project had failed. So my job was to go find out what happened, exactly like Columbo, like a detective. And so I had to go and unpack the whole situation to see what had gone wrong. And change management was a big part of that. So this actually fits nicely into your story and your question, if I think about it. This was a company trying to deliver a big bang change, spending literally hundreds of millions of pounds or dollars to make this change happen, working with the world's leading companies. And so they thought, yes, I paid this logo and this logo and this logo, and I should get a fantastic result. That did not happen. In fact, it went disastrously wrong for them. It was so wrong, in fact, you know, it was a national scandal, ended up on front page news that company X has had this failure. It affected their share price. You know, the CEO and the chairman and everybody else was on the line. And so this was a real high pressure situation. What had gone wrong, right? What had gone wrong? So I had to unpack this. So you uncoupled a bit about innovation. First, understand that, yes, this was their goal and what they wanted to achieve. And they went to the best possible companies to do it, but it did not work. And why? I was asked forensically to look at this, being a technology expert, to work out what happened. So I led a team to do this from my organization. I brought in 5-6 people. And the first thing, they took us to a warehouse to show us where they kept the documentation. It was the first thing we had to look at. Okay, let's look at the original specs, documentation. They said, oh, they're stored in a warehouse. We'll take you over there. And the client took me there. And it was like they opened the doors of this warehouse and then turned on the lights, or something like Raiders of the Lost Ark. Like, like, you know, all these lights came on and there were thousands of boxes, because it turned out this project had gone on for 10 years. So we had to unpack all those boxes and then start cataloging all the bits of paper and then start, you know, putting things up. It was the first meeting, second meeting, here was what was agreed, and here are the minutes of that meeting, and so on and so on and so on. And gradually build this entire story from start to finish about what happened and what went wrong. Now, to answer your question, change management had a major role to play, of course, in this. But also there were other problems that also arose, technical issues, misrepresentation from both parties, and so on and so on. Without getting into the details of it, I think this particular case then ended up becoming case law in the UK. But this is a classic kind of textbook scenario of many things going wrong, right? So just if I widen your premise slightly, say where innovation works and doesn't work, it's change management, yes, it's technology, also it's people and politics. All those things combined have to deliver the result. So sometimes things fail because of change management. That can be, you know, strictly in terms of, you know, making sure people are trained and they know what's going to happen and they attend things. And so, for example, this situation, we found that, for example, the users were not trained properly, or that classes were cut, or time was reduced. So the original plan says every person will get 60 minutes or 120 minutes or 3 days or whatever. And actually they only got 3 hours because they were close to the deadline and they just rushed it. So when it came to it and the system went live, people didn't know what to do. It has, again, it's very multifaceted. There's no simple answer, but just to recap, I think there's a strong emotional reaction, and I've had people shouting at me, first with small projects, and ultimately big ones as well. Did a lot of work in mergers and acquisitions, for example, advising companies on mergers, acquisitions, and divestitures, which is a very complicated subject, very high pressure. When you go in to see a client, you're talking about the change, either from technology perspective and or business point of view. The reaction can be very emotional. And it took a while for me to unpick that, to say, people are trying to pass what you're saying. They're trying to understand what it is that you're talking about, or maybe not, because they're actually fearful for the future. They're fearful for their jobs and their roles. And I've sat in meetings where the reaction was so strong and people had, was a kind of panic attacks, because they see you as the guy with the clipboard coming in. I'm a consultant. Mm-hmm. I've been appointed by somebody or their boss to speak to them about this. And people get extremely nervous. As if, you know, I'm going to get them fired or whatever. And so I soon learned, you know, a lot of it to have be successful is about putting people at ease, is about making sure the messaging is correct. And so over time, in my own time in the profession, this became more institutionalized as part of the methodology. The change management itself has become, you know, a discipline in and of itself. And you have all the toolkits and the methodologies. And then later on, when I've done other projects later in my career, always made sure I had that, or hired a change management professional to take that burden off me, to say, use the latest soft and hard techniques and methodologies and messaging, etc.
It's quite a tough job to be that person to come in. Like you said, you know, people are looking at you nervous. You're going to shake things up. You're going to make changes. It's going to affect them. Are they going to get, you know, fired? Is their work going to totally change? And it makes a lot of sense. Like you said, academia doesn't prepare you for that. You talked a lot about pressure. I mean, you were definitely working in seriously high pressure scenarios and very serious high stake cases and situations. So how did you handle the pressure? Did you have any kind of work-life balance? Did that not exist? How did you separate yourself from the work or the stress?
That's a good question. I think going through that phase, it was like I had to dedicate myself to the job, and I was working like 14, 15 hours a day. But I was relatively young and I didn't have any other responsibility. And I was committed to that, you know, from kind of a career perspective and wanting to, you know, tackle these sorts of projects and experiences. So, you know, the way I did it actually was to kind of have a very strict routine, you know, getting up, you know, super early, being the first person in the office, being the last person to leave, shaking everyone's hand, as it were, on the way out, be it the client or the team, making sure that, you know, you're only getting a value out of this if you can motivate people. So making sure that my team, who are mostly, you know, relatively young people, were, you know, properly engaged and motivated, and then hitting the gym and making sure I was trying to take care of myself, you know, and eating properly and that kind of thing. You had to be almost wholly dedicated to that. But often, you know, for these sorts of high pressure situations, I think that's the only way you're going to get through it. You have to be dedicated to that particular mission for that period. The payoff being that, you know, it's a finite thing, right? It will end at some point. This project will come to a conclusion. There will be a delivery, and then you move on, and you have to adjust to the reality post that. Now, is that sustainable forever? No. I mean, obviously, you know, I grew, I matured later on, I got married and so on. And then you migrate to, you know, different roles, different organizations, different setups. And you realize, you know, over time, you know, some companies are set up exactly that way, and that's what they want to get out of people. But if you keep doing that, you'll hit some sort of burnout. I saw that happen as well. I don't think it happened to me, but I saw that happen to other people. And so then you have to be careful about what you pick and choose. And of course, everyone has to accelerate and slow down when you're working on something. If you're running your own business, or if you are, you know, working in a job, these peaks and troughs are normal, but you need to find that middle ground and find time for yourself. Making sure you take care of your spiritual needs, your health needs, your physical needs are just as important. But there was a short period, I think, you know, with that kind of that mentality, the sort of Wall Street slash, you know, hustling slash, mm-hmm. you know, London mentality, you know, working 20 hours a day and whatever. It's like, no. I had some colleagues of mine who were lawyers who worked for some big firms, and they said, I was working this like this. And they're like, that's nothing. I was like, you know, we don't go home sometimes for 4, 5, 6 days. I'm like,
oh,
really?
God.
I said, yeah, they have beds in the office, and we have a thing. So, you know, we work 19 hours and we sleep 2 hours, and then we carry on. And then if we're there for more than a day, they'll pay for our laundry. If you're there for more than 2 days, they'll pay for new shirts. If you're more than a week, they'll buy you a new suit.
Oh my God, that's insane. But
yes,
you know, we know it exists and it's real. Obviously not sustainable. Like you said, there's going to be periods in your life where you can go all in, do the crazy hours, not have a work-life balance. And then there are going to be times in your life that is just not what's happening. You can't do that. That's not realistic to your lifestyle. No matter what, I guess it's in some form of moderation. And if you're really passionate and excited about doing it and wanna work like crazy because it's important to you, you believe in it, you're excited about it, I think that's a different story. You, Samar, when you look at your resume, your LinkedIn, it's like, damn, all the big names, SAP, Deloitte, IBM, Philips, KPMG. It's like, this guy has his stuff together. He has his shit together. But part of the podcast, of course, is to talk the real talk and talk about how we're all trying to figure it out. We all mess up. It's not linear. So if you're willing to share one of your biggest fuck ups or, you know, kerfuffle, whatever fun word you want to use, because you look like you got it all together and you got it all figured out. So tell us.
Yeah, no, I wish. It wasn't always a straight line to success. I think, you know, when you climbed to a certain level, if you look at it from the outside, I guess it looks like that. And of course, you know, any social media profile is going to tell you the good stuff, right? Doesn't tell you the blood, sweat, and tears and the suffering that went into that. But you say, you know, if it looks good, it looks effortless, right? If you're doing it properly, you know, like watching tennis pros or something, that looks easy, you know, but of course it's taken dedication. And so, you know, I've had to do that, but where things went wrong, early on, I'll say, look, when I graduated initially and did my bachelor's, I didn't get the best possible grades I could have. I was disappointed. I did not get the opportunities then, therefore, at that time. A number of my friends went off to California and joined dot-coms, and I was desperate to follow them, and that just didn't happen for me. I just didn't quite cut it at that time. So those opportunities didn't come around. But then, as I say, then I took other routes to say, you know, find your passion. And I did that whole thing, and they got me on the pathway to becoming a computer operator. I took some advice to say, okay, if you want to get into IT properly, you need to have a skill. It's fine, you got a degree, but you need to have, you know, a practical, tangible skill that people want, and you'll find roles. So that's what I did, right? And So I remember once I did that, and I certified as an operator, and I certified as a programmer, and then I got a job at investment bank. And then I had that major drive at that time. This environment at the bank was, or this institution was, a little bit traditional, a bit slow, a bit risk averse from a technology point of view. I would say, you know, they were open minded. That's not entirely fair, but you know, to kind of 21-year-old, 22-year-old is like, oh, this is like a million miles away from Silicon Valley, you know. very, very different culture. And so I wanted to kind of join a startup because all my friends were joining startups. And so I found a startup in London that was doing banking software, and it was in my niche. They offered me a job. I signed up with them. I quit my job. And then about a week before I was about to join, still doing my notice, they said, oh, sorry, we've had an issue. We can't take you on. So they withdrew the offer.
And you already
So I had nowhere to go. Yeah, and I asked my old boss, can I have my job back or can I stay? He's like, no, sorry, we'll offer the role to somebody else. I'm like, okay, fine. So there you go. At that point in time, I suddenly felt like, you know, the ground had opened up and I've made a big, big mistake and that was wrong and I should have taken a risk. And other people saying, you got a great job, why are you doing this? But it did tell me a couple of things, right? Is that, you know, number one, there are risks. Sooner or later, risks won't go your way. Hopefully, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And if I felt strongly that, you know, the environment wasn't right for me long-term in this institution, then it's fine to step out and explore the world. Right now, still relatively young and could do things. So I decided to go back to university. So this step or misstep actually set me on the journey and how I ended up talking to you today. If that hadn't happened, life could have turned out very differently, you know, but sometimes these junctions happen. But yeah, having that experience and effectively kind of losing your job before it started was a pretty hard break. I'd say that was definitely one. And then in other times in all these organizations, again, I think like anybody else, everyone experiences peaks and troughs. You know, there's certain times when things are going brilliantly and you in a particular team or group and everything is going the right direction and it's really inspirational. The other times, not so. You know, being through these companies over time, I wouldn't say that every single one has been, you know, a bed of roses throughout. That's obviously not true. And anyone listening to your podcast would know that. If you spend any time at any institution of any size, there's going to be good and bad things. So without getting into too many details, I mean, I've had all sorts of issues like anybody else along the way, you know, difficult projects, bad times, difficult personalities, you know, thinking about quitting or whatever. But the overarching thing, if you're answering the question, what should I do with my life, is that this is part of the DNA of navigating through organizations, right? The only way you can totally avoid it, I learned from other people as well, is that you have to run your own business, if you like, right? If you run your own business, then you own it and then you don't necessarily have a boss telling you what to do and you're making decisions. But then with that equally comes a set of other pressures of running your own business, right? And then actually you also have to manage people a lot more directly and keep them motivated to do the jobs that you need them to do. And this is also a major challenge. Now, if you're willing to invest all of that, then of course the risk and reward is much more yours than it is working in a corporate job. And in theory, the chances of reward are infinite, right? If that business really takes off and grows, then you know that's yours, right? That's how you can truly, truly earn spectacular returns. You won't become a multi-billionaire, you know, working for an organization. But the flip side offers stability, offers some kind of framework, offers an organization with other people, like-minded people and peers. And you do have a layer of professionals around you who are handling the day-to-day, legal, HR, finance, and so on, marketing, which creates a framework for you, right? So you can, if that's an environment, if you like, you're kind of maybe a bit of a fish tank perhaps, but you do have degrees of protection, right? But then you pursue avenues and opportunities and with a different expectation, right? It's not going to create, you know, not going to set up the next Tesla or whatever, but and who knows, you might do. And work for organizations that offered you to do that, bearing in mind you sign away your intellectual property. So you used to work for IBM. That's the first thing that they do. First thing that you sign is any discovery that you make, any patent that you have, any product that you invent in the course of your employment,
is this
belongs to the corporation, right? Mm-hmm. Which is why then people do become epically successful if they have a great idea and then take the risk to say, okay, I'm going to move on and set something up myself and explore this idea or innovation.
There's definitely a lot of pros and cons to working in a corporation. I think that what you said before, you took a risk and that wasn't a mess up. You know, you took a risk that's always going to possibly lead to some kind of possible mess up. But the reality is that's what it means to take a risk. It's going to go one way or the other. And like you said, you ended up getting you, it was very integral to your story and how you got to where you are. To pivot a little, you do a lot of posting on LinkedIn. You are a thought leader when it comes to personal branding, content creation, public speaking. You have the Strategy Remix. So I would love to just hear a bit about these topics, how you got into them. What is the Strategy Remix?
Yes, so Strategy Remix is a live podcast brand I've been building on LinkedIn. So using the LinkedIn live audio platform, I wanted to create a space where we could talk as technology professionals, as people in the industry, without having to represent necessarily, you know, always our employers or the brands that we work for. Because I felt that, you know, our experience is as relevant as anybody else, right? And you don't have to always be representing just only your employer's brand online, right? This is perhaps kind of obvious to digital natives, but I think to others who are more hesitant or a bit older, you are an individual. You do have your own thoughts and opinions, right? And they're perfectly valid. Of course, I do have an employer now to be conscious of what I'm saying. But aside from any controversial topic, there's a whole universe of topics to be explored around, for example, management effectiveness, public speaking, projection, building confidence. And all these are of great interest, I think, to people who want to develop their careers or interested in or around the technology industry or in business in general. I've always been approached by people the last few years saying, oh, you know, you talk really well on this topic. I think you should write a book. You should write a book. I keep getting asked about that. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'd love to write a book. But firstly, I'd like to build some narratives. And I think also through the Strategy Remix, I'm able to express those and perhaps mm-hmm. tap the inner feeling or thought that I have around a particular business topic and think, yeah, well, I can start to flesh that out. What I found by doing this, and I chose Strategy Remix as a live social audio format, is that it's interactive, right? It's live, not pre-recorded. And so you do have that element of unpredictability, who's going to join, what they're going to say, how they're going to interact. And this kind of creates a more sort of a live radio type feel in terms of content. And obviously you joined me for Strategy Remix as well, you know, so it's kind of exactly like live radio,
yeah.
Like a phone in, you got people popping in with their opinions. So this has been a platform for me to share those insights and start to build a following, which then I hope, you know, in the medium term that I can start to build that into a wider platform of content and a good following, which eventually then I can also use to, for example, you know, be a target audience for some other content and such as a book or similar that I might produce.
I think it's a really good outlet. And, you know, we spoke about with COVID and working from home and you and I liking to be out and about and with people and kind of missing that. And that's when I started the podcast. That's when you got into Strategy Remix and kind of exploring these opportunities and outlets. I think everyone has something to share. Often we discredit our experience and our knowledge and who am I to say this or who would listen to me, but we all kind of have our own expertise and a unique, we all have some kind of unique perspective that could be for sure yes. valuable to others. So I love that.
Yep. I read a stat that I think in the US, I think about, you know, you ask people, about 40% of people would say they'd like to write a book, but actually only 2% of people write a book. What that means is, you know, that 98% potentially, you know, of very useful insights, opinions, experiences are lost because people don't share them, right? And so if you're one of them, if you're a listener to What Should I Do With My Life or the Strategy Remix or any other forum, quite rightly, your opinions, your thoughts are just as valid as anyone else's. So do share them, you know, reach out to us and more than happy to magnify them, work with you to get them out there, because that insight could really change someone's perspective, make a difference, right? So don't discount what it is that you have to share.
And find an outlet that works well for you. Don't just focus on what works well for everyone. Is it a podcast? Is it, you know, a live LinkedIn? Is it a YouTube video? Is it a live event with people there? Think about what works well for you. What would you say to someone who doesn't know what to do with their lives? What advice would you give?
Well, take a deep breath, get some fresh air, right? Firstly, perspective is very important, right? Number one, I think, is to understand, firstly. So perhaps you need to get away from some of the day-to-day noise and find a clear place to think. Wherever that is, you know, find a happy space. Start to think about the advice I give when people ask me is to firstly think about what it is that you want to get out of life, right? Very simply, where do you want to be in 5, 10, 20, 30 years, whatever that is? It doesn't matter how ridiculous it might sound to somebody else. This is your choice. If you say, you know, I want to be a billionaire with a yacht and this and that, that's absolutely fine. If you say, you know, I want a log cabin by a lake, whatever, that's perfectly fine, right? This is something that you want and it's personal. And then start to map a plan on how to get there. And there's several ways to get it, whether it's pursuing a career to get a job in a particular way that might pay so much money that over time you can achieve that goal. Great. Or founding a business or whatever. But you know, at the end of the day, you have a goal. And this ultimately, I think, is where often people struggle, myself included. I won't say I'm entirely immune from this, but having a goal in mind is extremely important, a vision, right? And then taking steps towards that vision every day. As life changes, adjusting that vision is perfectly fine, but you know where you want to be. And sometimes you have to do things you don't always enjoy. Sometimes you might. But if that is whatever that vision is, you need to crystallize it, think about it, paint it, write it down, draw it, draw a mind map, whatever it is. I want to be like this. I want to achieve this. I want to be there for my family or my loved ones or whatever it is for you. Crystallize it. Have it always in your mind. Keep it close to your heart. And then whatever journey life takes you on, you know that's your destination. And every day, every week, every month, every year, you're taking a step towards it.
How do you tap into what you want? How do you find out what is that goal? It's hard.
So how do you find out that goal? I mean, that's your own deep inner desire, right? Whatever that is. I mean, it might be more emotionally driven. Let's say, for example, you want to find fulfillment of some sort, right? Not that it has to be about money and material wealth. You know, you might find fulfillment in teaching or the joy of serving people or your country or your nation or whatever. Often those things per se don't often pay a lot of money, but that's not the point. That's not what you're doing it for, right? You're trying to find something that gives you fulfillment. That's almost, that's the most important thing. What you don't want to do is reach a certain age, be 70, 80 years old and look back on that and say, I didn't do what I wanted to do, right? And then when you're deciding on a mix of things, you can mix those things. Say, I'll do a bit of this and a bit of that. That will drive, create fulfillment for me, create harmony for you, some inner peace to say, I've done things that I wanted to do. I've done things that serve others. I feel better about that. So that you have a well-rounded vision. I mean, I spent some time in the city and around Wall Street and this and that. And I met those types, very cutthroat, whose absolute vision was just X. And they did not care. And they'd steamroll at everybody. You knew who those people were. And now, you know, 20, 25 years later, I think a handful of those have actually achieved it. But I don't necessarily think that drives inner peace, right? To say, yes, you know, I was a stockbroker on Wall Street for 15, 20 years. I did ABCD and I'm a blah, blah, blah. Okay. But either you are perhaps suffering in another way. Yeah,
perhaps. You're probably suffering a lot.
Yes.
Doesn't matter if you have a yacht or a penthouse.
Yes, yes. Hmm. So you got to find your inner desire, inner peace. And it doesn't always come with the first try. But take time, take advice, think about it, paint, read, draw, find inspiration.
I love it. Yeah, really making the space to find what it is you want and tap into yourself. Samar, where can people follow you, get involved in Strategy Remix, stay up to date with you and your thought leadership, your content?
LinkedIn is my primary channel. So I think you'll share the link I'm Samar Farooqi, SamarFarooqi. So you can find me on LinkedIn. That's my primary channel. I'm also on Twitter, but that's LinkedIn is where I am mostly. So please reach out to me, connect with me, have any questions, happy to answer those, or have anyone who's interested join me as a guest on a future edition of the Strategy Remix.
You should. It was a lot of fun, super interesting, great audience participation. So I recommend it. There are so many other things I wanted to talk to you about, but maybe we'll do a part two or continue the conversation. This was so awesome. So thank you so, so much.
Likewise.
Yay.
Thank you. Thank you, Stephanie.
Hi, everyone. I hope you learned a lot from Samar. There's so much more I wanted to dive into with him, but alas, we just might need to continue this conversation. Personally, loved hearing Samar's story about where his love for innovation began, this impactful moment, this formative experience he had when his dad showed him an IBM PC, and it sparked something in him that from a young age, he wanted to work in computers. I love that. I also love when Samar said, sooner or later, risks won't go your way. Hopefully sometimes they do, but sometimes they don't. This is just the most honest, important thing when it comes to taking a risk, but the leap is often worth it. And like we saw with Samar, the risk he took, aka leaving a comfy job for a startup whose offer then fell through, it ultimately led him onto the path he is today. So in the moment, the risk didn't work out, quote unquote, like he hoped, but in the long run, it was a crucial part of his journey. Also, as we talk about in the end of the episode, we all have something to share. It's easy to discredit our experience and knowledge, our unique perspective. It could really be valuable to others. We have our own insights, thoughts, and opinions. And as long as we're conscientious of our employers and we're not ramping up the controversial topics, our insights could really be impactful to someone, change their perspective, or make a difference. So we all need to be more confident putting ourselves out there. You can follow Samar on LinkedIn. I'll share his link in the show notes. And make sure to follow Strategy Remix also on LinkedIn. And that is it for today. See you next time.